This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to the UCSB Technology Management Program Distinguished Speaker Series. Tonight, we're honored to present Ms. Libby Gill, the former head of communications and public relations for Sony, Universal, and Turner Broadcasting. She was also the branding brain behind the Dr. Phil show. Libby is now CEO of Libby Gill & Company, an executive coaching and consulting firm. She helps companies such as Disney, ABC, Wells Fargo, eBay, Kellogg's, Microsoft, Royal Caribbean, Safeway, Warner Brothers, all create highly engaged cultures of innovation, inspiration, and bold leadership. Libby has shared her success strategies on CNN, NPR, The Today Show, and in Business Week, Time, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and several other publications. She's an award-winning author. Her latest book is Capture the Mindshare, and the Market Share Will Follow, The Art and Science of Building Brands. Please give a UCSB warm welcome to Libby Gill.
Pleasure to be here. And as I was preparing tonight, I thought, what will be the most useful thing I can share with you? And I really thought, I've got two college-age students, two sons. One's in grad school, one's a sophomore at Oberlin. The other is a UC grad, UCSD, go Tritons. And I know how difficult it is to establish your own brand. And it may seem at this stage of your education, your career, it may seem like a little premature to think about your brand. And when you think about that, when I say it, it's not with a big B, but it's with a small B. It's who you are. It's what you stand for. It's what people see when they meet you or they look at your LinkedIn page or they interview you for an internship or a job or a course. And I thought maybe that would be the most useful. And I know we're going to take some questions afterward, but I want to share some ideas about what it means to build your leadership brand. And when I talk about leadership, and I talk to corporations, as you heard from Dr. Sterling, all over the country and around the world, leadership to me is not about a title, it's not a level, it's not a salary, it's not the office. It is where you give value, and I'm talking about leadership at all levels of any organization. So you are all emerging leaders, as I would call you. And I want to jump into this idea. And a little bit about me. You heard from Dr. Sterling a little bit about my background. I started my career working at a company that was pre-Sony. It was actually a small television production distribution company started by a very well-known television producer and writer, Norman Lear, who was famous for many sitcoms through the 70s and the 80s that all live on today. And I thought, what a great opportunity to work at this mid-sized company where I'll get a hand in everything. And I was hired as a PR assistant. And very quickly, that small company was swallowed up by Columbia Pictures, and then Coca-Cola, and then Sony. And I just kept raising my hand with every merger. That's the point where some people kind of duck and cover, you know, dive under the desk when a merger, a transition, a big change is coming. But to me, it was a time, well, let's see what I can do. And I just kept raising my hand and then thinking, oh, I'll figure it out afterward. Whatever it is, I just got myself into. And I was able to get a promotion a year for 5 years, which is pretty unusual. Some of it was luck of the draw and the fact that there was a lot of change, but also because I asked for it. I asked for it, and then I did the job, and then I got the next job. So in 5 years, I went from being an assistant to being vice president of publicity, advertising, and promotion for Sony's worldwide television group. After that, I went on to Turner and then to Universal Studios, where I headed up corporate communications for the TV group. And now I've been in business for myself almost as long as I was in the corporate world. And just between us, I gotta say, having your own business is really fun. Not that there's anything wrong with the corporate world, but how many of you are entrepreneurs? I assume that's why. How many of you want to work in the private sector in corporate America? How many of you in nonprofit? There are so many different, academia. so many different ways to go. There are so many opportunities, but this is a great time to start thinking about who you are, what your skills are, your strengths, what you still need to learn and develop, what your passions are, and ultimately, what a hirer, what a customer, what a client, what a colleague, what a hiring manager wants from you. That's all about building your brand. Oh, yeah. Your brand, this is what Dr. Phil said about me. Libby Gill is one of those people who gets it. It's a great endorsement to have along the way as you collect thank you letters, endorsements from people that you've worked with, those to whom it may concern letters that you collect. Those are all great things to tuck away in your file. You never know when you're going to need them. Jeff Bezos, you all know who that is, of course. The founder of Amazon said, your brand is what people say about you when you leave the room. Think about that. It's really what people say about you behind your back. That's a pretty good definition of a brand. Your brand is other people's perception of you. What you know, what you can do, the track record you have, how trustworthy you are. It's what the value, it's always about the value that you bring to others. All right. I want to talk about success, and this is my simple, if there is a secret to success, to me, this is it. It's not that many people wake up with a bold idea. Steve Jobs didn't wake up one day and say, let's invent the iPod. He didn't even create it. It was an iterative process over time. That's usually what it takes. But this is kind of my secret sauce to success, and I want to ask you some questions and have you think about how this relates to you. The first step to creating a successful, whether it's an academic career or your future career, have a vision. And I know that's you've heard that before. What does it mean? So I want you to wrap your head around it. Have a vision, and I'll ask you to write this down right now. By the way, I'll share this PowerPoint with Dr. Sterling, so if you're taking notes based on this, don't do that. Take your own notes for you. And this is yours, so don't invent the wheel. Clarify your vision. I want you to think about if you're back in this room, maybe you're graduating, maybe you're back for a reunion, whatever it is. So say we're back together a year from today. What has to happen? I know you're going to go to class. I know you're going to deal with your family. I know you've got a job. You're going to take care of all that day-to-day stuff. That's a given. But what is that one-year vision that you have for yourself that's going to elevate the game? What do you need to do that's going to take you to a different level, stretch your limits, make you a little gutsier, a little bolder than you would be, maybe left to your own devices? So that's what I mean by clarifying the vision. Got that? Think about it now. If it's more, and fill in that sentence, my vision is, and write that down. If it's more than five words, it's too long. You're thinking like students. Boil it down to 3 to 5 words and think about that's what it is. I do this every year for myself. I set a new area of my business. This year I created an online course. Wanted to harness technology, wanted to create a different way to communicate and offer value to my customers. It was a whole new undertaking. It required a lot of research, a little risk-taking. There were moments I thought I got in over my head, but it was what was new for this year. So you clarify that vision. Next, simplify the path. Anybody think we live in a fairly complex, complicated world? And that most people are out there to further complicate it for you. In the business world, the bosses that I think are the best, the greatest leaders, are the ones who bring things down to size, not the ones who make things so lofty that you can't possibly wrap your head around the vision. Or connect your contributions to the greater mission of the organization. And this is for anywhere you work. You want to see what your contribution to the whole is. And that's really about simplifying the communication and the pathway. So if you've clarified that vision for yourself, I'm going to go after this job, or I'm going to nail this internship, or I'm going to apply to grad school, then think about that, and then how do you make it simpler for yourself? Get stuff out of the way. Stop. You may have to nail down and get some of the time wasters out of the way. You may have to change some bad habits. You may have to have a few people step aside for a moment while you do what you need to do. Not forever, but you want to create that space to reach it. Then you want to bring in what you need. Expert help, conversations with, there's so many professors that are there to help you. I taught for 1 year at Cal State Northridge. I taught a pilot class, an entertainment business class. And I knew, I made my phone number, my cell phone, my email available to everybody because I knew the smallest handful of people would ever take advantage of it. And I mean take advantage in a good way, would ever pick up the phone and call me or shoot me an email. Because most people don't act on those things. We'll talk about that a little bit more, but get what you need. Finally, you got to execute. That's what the world looks for, the business world. They look for people who make things happen. It doesn't matter if it's an entry-level job. Do that as well as you possibly can. Make things happen, and this is where it gets tricky. You need to let people know about your results. You need to let them know strategically and gracefully what you've done for them. You can't always take it for granted that everybody will see what you've done, which doesn't mean raise your hand every 2 seconds and say, me, 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 look what I did. But you need to find ways to start to demonstrate the value that you bring. So let's think about this, how you clarify a non-negotiable view of success. What do you need to do so that you create that clear picture of success? Well, think about what you want to do and then define it. If you can define it, you can do it. And can you deliver it? Can you measure it? And most of all, can you articulate it to others? I'll tell you about some of the things that you might be thinking, and I'll tell you about some of the organizations that use this very same model. We're going to clarify the vision. They may think out 3 years or 5 years. For human beings, not corporations, to me, 1 year or 18 months makes a lot more sense. You can wrap your head around that. You can do something. Maybe you're doing one of these things. You're looking to graduate. You know, got to go to class. You got to finish that all your requirements. Continue your education. Go on to school. Get an internship. Find a job. All of these things. Think about that one thing that would really move the needle on your life. Next, you've got to simplify, as I mentioned. And here are some ways that people simplify. You all study other organizations. I've been talking about Zappos even before, long before the CEO, Tony Hsieh, began to talk about Zappos himself. And I'll give you an example of one of the ways that they simplify the actions to really elevate their vision. You all know Zappos, yet everybody knows from either as a consumer or as a following different businesses. And one interesting thing, and maybe you've seen some of the fallout lately, but they've established this holacracy. Has anybody seen that? Everybody's equal. My theory on that is, well, it doesn't work very often, and it's not working in their case, is that leadership bubbles up. Even if you take away the titles, the leaders will emerge, and as I think they should. But one of the things they did when they first put themselves on the map, and this I haven't seen in print so much, even though I talk about them in my book, You Unstuck. Tony Hsieh told me this, that when they were trying to establish themselves against all the bigger players like Amazon and the retail outlets, they decided that they had to do things like free delivery, 365 days a year. But another thing they did to really form that relationship, the emotional connection with their customer, they got rid of their call scripts. So when you call, and even though it's basically an e-commerce company, their phone number is on every page of their website. You pick up the phone and call them, and someone answers and has a conversation. They don't read a script. They don't roll their calls. They don't time them. They'll ask you where you're from. They'll ask you what the weather's like. They'll tell you a joke. They'll chat with you. Very unusual for that type of business. And they wanted to establish that for everybody, set that framework within that reasonable guidelines, but there's a lot of flexibility in there so you can bring your own personality forward. And then what they also did, which I thought was really interesting, was if you call and you're looking for something, say you're looking for size, 11 shoes, they don't have your shoes in stock, those same clerks, the Salesforce people, can go to up to three other websites to find those shoes. So they will send you to the competition. Anybody remember the old movie Miracle on 34th Street? It's out every year, right? They send Macy's. If they didn't have their gift, they'd send you to Gimbel's. It's the same idea. If they don't have your shoes, they'll send you elsewhere. And anybody is empowered to do that. The reason is they don't want the sale. They want the customer. And they know this is working because on any given day, 75% of their sales are to returning customers. So they've put that in place to honor their vision. They've added parameters and structure around it, and then they've measured it, and it works. Fascinating, right, that you would do that, that you would send people to the competition. But that's how you align those actions with your end goal. When I was at Universal, my vision there for my first year, I was brought over. I was working at Turner Broadcasting, and I was offered a similar job, head of public and media relations at CBS and at Universal at the same time. It's what I call a high-class problem, nice problem to have. And I decided to go with Universal because at that time, the company had the most stable leadership in the history of entertainment. Same guy, famous mogul, Lou Wasserman, if you know anything about studio history, at the helm, had been there for many, many years, which meant the company was really stable, debt-free, really strong. But as a result of that 50 years of management, there was a lot of fat. There were a lot of people that shouldn't be there. There were a lot of outmoded systems. And the structure, the reporting, the org charts were so crazy. It was like this person had a fight with that person a decade ago, so now they're moved over here. I mean, nothing made sense. It was more historical than it was rational. And it was like little fiefdoms all over the studio. It was siloed. People really worked in their own little department and rarely talked with anybody else. And even when I was there to centralize, there were five different television divisions within the group that I came in with, and I had to sort of ferret out, you know, who were the communications execs, because they now all worked for me. And once I pulled them together, I discovered, and this I see now today all the time, I had people who did essentially the same job. VP of communications for network television, VP of communications for cable television, had both worked at the studio 15, 20 years, two buildings apart, but had never thought, even though they had essentially the same job, wouldn't it be interesting to share some synergies, to find out your best practices, to see if there are any resources we could swap, or at the very least to share their war stories. But no, they were so divided into their own little silos that they'd never even spoken to each other. I found that amazing. So my first day, my staff meeting where I gathered people up and they looked like, you know, I was about to line them up in front of a firing squad, I said, forget it, we're going into the theme park, because the executive tower, the studio, is right up against the theme park, and we all went and rode ride the rides for the afternoon, which seemed like a much better way to get acquainted and bond. But when I got there and I discovered not only my own staff, but everybody out there was in these little silos, I thought, it's my mission to communicate. I'm the head of communications. Let's get to know people. And I requested meetings. It's not like today you send a calendar invite. I had to pick up the phone and ask for a 15-minute meeting to introduce myself. And I got so much resistance. It was so surprising to me that people didn't want to know the new. They didn't want to hear from the new people. They didn't want to change. A level of fear comes up, a level of resistance. If you've ever had a big task or, you know, a big exam or paper or something, you feel that, I call it the INR, the immediate negative response. And it's how we're hardwired. It's that chemical reaction that we get when fear comes in, and it's to danger or perceived danger. So these people were like, nope, don't want to talk to you. It took me about 3 months to make the rounds of everybody from the accounting to the HR to the development folks to the talent, the producers, and then the tour guys, even the guys in the wood mill that made our sets. But I was intent on breaking down those barriers so that we could share in success. And that's a lot about what you do now on internships, on first jobs, and classes, sharing with others, breaking down those barriers. And yes, there are times you are in competition, but you can determine when it's friendly competition and more often you can share with not, which in the corporate world, critical to your success. Finally, you want to execute your plan. You've got to execute what you're doing with very aggressive action. Flawless follow-through. So when you say, hey, this is my vision, I'm going to get this entry-level job, entry-level corporate job, multinational, whatever it is, and here's how I'm going to go about it. I'm going to network with people. I'm going to get my LinkedIn page. I'm going to talk to people. I'm going to check in with people I know. I'm going to go back to my professors, get letters of recommendation. Well, then you have to do it. That's the part where it really comes down to taking those actions. I find that if I set that theme for the year and then break it into quarterly actions, you sort of have that by quarters already, I start breaking that into action, I'm much more likely to make things happen. That's what gets me moving forward. So what you always know is coming as you're building your career, as you're out there in front of people, as you're creating job opportunities. We were just talking earlier with a group that about 70% of your job opportunities come through networking. And as you go even higher up the ladder, fewer come from the job postings or any of that. They come almost exclusively from networking. And invariably, even now, at whatever stage you're in of your career, your academic life, people will say, so what do you do? Or the variation that I've learned from my kids. Don't ask a student, what do you want to do after college? But I actually encourage you to have an answer to that. And guess what? It can change after that one conversation, or your first job, or after whatever you decide, this is not my path. But have an answer to that question. What do you want to do? And you can be torn between two things. You can have a few ideas. But as you go out and start talking to people, you need to craft that brand promise. And I want to help you sort of bring that down to earth for where you are now so you can begin to answer that less about, so what do you do? That's the question I get and my colleagues get. And you know it's coming from everything from a business meeting to a social event, but the so what do you want to do after school or after you graduate? And looking at brands, and then we're going to take this into your brand, successful brands have a lot in common, right? They have a lot in common with each other. Brands that you like. Who's Starbucks, Apple, what do you all think? I'll repeat it for the tape. What are brands that you think are powerful? Nike, great brand, right? The swoosh, I talk about that all the time, just do it. And yes, it is not an urban legend, but a student really did create that Nike swoosh. An intern who was making, I think, $3 an hour or something, but bragging rights for life, right? Who else has a strong, great brand? Coca-Cola? Yeah, absolutely, Coca-Cola. It's interesting, in my book, Capture the Mindshare, I have a study on how Coca-Cola's brand has changed over the years. They've got their core brand, but they keep refreshing it, making it relevant every year. But what successful brands that last, have in common, they deliver consistent value, right? You know, and yes, everybody goofs, which is a great opportunity to make a client even happier because you've fixed a problem. I mean, there's a famous, back to the Zappos story, you know, famous for customer service. There is a story, I thought this was a legend, but in fact, I heard it from Tony Hsieh, that there was a group of executives that were gathered at a conference, Tony Hsieh, the CEO of Zappos, being one of them. And this group of people, where it was after the day of events, and they were in a hotel room, and it was late at night, and they wanted a pizza. But the kitchen of the restaurant, I mean, of the hotel was already closed. So they looked at their buddy Tony and said, hey, you guys are famous for customer service. Get your guys to order a pizza. And he said, you know, we do sell shoes. We're not in the pizza business. Yeah, but you're the customer service people. He had one of them pick up the phone and said, don't tell them I'm here. He called. He got a guy on the call line at Zappos, you know, hello, this is Fred, how can I help you? And this fellow said, well, I'm in Chicago and the hotel's closed and I don't know where to get a great pizza delivered. That guy said, give me 10 minutes and I'll call you back. What's your phone number? And I kid you not, he found a restaurant that would deliver a pizza to their hotel room at 11:30 at night. So that's about going above and beyond, but great brands deliver consistent value. They confirm credibility. That's one thing you've got to do all the time when you're starting and for the rest of your career. Why are you the right person for this mission, for this job, for this internship, for whatever it is? You've got to be able to confirm that. It doesn't mean you always have to have apples to apples experience, especially when you're starting out. But you have to explain why you were great at the last thing that you did, or why your record or your LinkedIn page says it all for you. You want to connect emotionally. As you're out there networking and meeting people, and that includes, don't forget, everybody that you know someone that you don't know. That's what networking is, creating the snowball effect, is that you really want to connect with them in some way. Look at, how many of you have a LinkedIn page? Oh, most of you, that's great. And if you don't, you need to put, no, yes? Now, okay, you need to put one up. It can be very simple and straightforward. Look at one of your colleagues or friends and see what they're doing. The way I've found people network really successfully is to say, hey, I saw you went to UCSB, or I saw you went to Berkeley. You've got that in common. Not really in common, but it sounds like it. Find a way to connect. Hey, I see that you're a lacrosse player. Me too. Find that way in that email, that phone call, that one-on-one meeting. Find enough out about the other person that you can make that connection. I guarantee you people will remember you. I just met with your, what do you call the group I was just in, the EAT, at the technology group, the association group, and somebody said, hey, would you mentor me? You talk a lot about mentoring in your book. Good question. Would you mentor me? And I said, here's what I'll do. Pick up the phone, remind me who you are. If I can take your phone call, I will. If I can't, shoot me an email. And yes, from time to time, we can stay in touch. That took real guts. I could have easily said, I don't have time for you. And I may not have time for him, and he recognized that, but that's what it takes. You create that connection. It didn't hurt that he's studying something similar to what my son majored in at UC San Diego. See, I already feel that connection, and like I need to help him. Your brand, or the best brands, motivate people to act, right? If a brand is really speaking to you, you do something. You buy the product. You click on the link. You learn more about it. You pick up the phone. Brands that work motivate people to do something. That's the same for you. If you want someone to do something for you, you've got to motivate, inspire them. Sometimes you simply hand them the script. Gee, I see you know so-and-so. Would you make an introduction for me? And finally, those great brands that we love. I'm a total Mac head. I drank the Apple Kool-Aid. I know it's more expensive and maybe not that much better than everybody else, but I can't help it. I love it. I will be a Mac person probably for life. I like the Genius Bar. I like that all my gadgets, you know, intertwine. We have brands that connect to us that sort of put us in their clubs. They create that kind of long-term loyalty. That's what you can do with the connections that you're making. So what do you do to develop your very own brand? Is this helpful to you? Do you all recognize that even though you're not commodities, you're not shampoo, you're not products, that you need a brand? I don't care what you call it, a reputation, an image, a persona, something that people is meaningful and memorable to other people. So the way that you can craft this, because it is a craft, is to create a brand promise statement, and I'll explain that in just a minute and give you a little formula for that. You need to, I mentioned bring value to others. I'll probably say that about 6 more times. That's the best thing you can do. And when somebody says, hey, will you mentor me or would you do this, ask what you can do for them. And if you can't, ask who else in their network you could do something helpful for. Another thing is to build an informal, you can call them your board of directors, your network, your inner circle, but begin to think, they don't have to know this, by the way, that they've been tapped by you to be on this informal board, so that when you realize, hey, I need somebody who knows technology, or I need biotech, I need somebody who really understands business, I need somebody who's in a PhD program somewhere that I aspire to, whatever it is, start thinking about building your personal team. And it's really fascinating when you think about it in this way, and some people, if you're close to them, you can say, hey, I really need you on my corner. Would you do X for me? When I left the corporate world, left Universal, and started my own business, and I wasn't altogether sure what I was going to do. You probably all know much more about business plans and spreadsheets and sales projections and technology than I did at that point. But I went back to my former boss from Sony, and I'd not worked with him for a decade. And I said, look, I'm starting this business. I explained it as best I could with my brand statement. And I said, would you be willing to help me and advise me? He happened to be a really brilliant business guy. And I said, I just want to be able to pick up the phone and call you on a quarterly basis. And he said, just for advice about building the business. And he said, no, pick up the phone whenever you want, and let's have breakfast once a month. And we had breakfast once a month for about 18 months until I was up and running. He also would never let me pick up the check, which I thought was, and I tried every single time. But that was just asking for that help, which is so hard for us to do, right, can be really difficult. So I'll try this out on you. I sometimes ask this question when I'm speaking. How many of you like to give advice? You like it when somebody solicits your opinion. They want to know your point of view. Just show of hands. How does it feel? It feels pretty good, right? Right. Okay, now leave them up. If you said, yeah, it feels really good. I know there are a couple of people that never want to give any advice. Now, how many of you like the feeling of having to go and ask someone for help or connections or their network or access to something? Yeah, a lot of hands go down. Not you. Good for you. But there's a disconnect. There's always one in the group. Good. And that's how you should feel. Because you see the disconnect? So many of us feel honored. Whoa, I think I know something. I can help. I can weigh in here. And to most of us, it feels pretty good to offer something that we know or something that comes easily for us. But on the other hand, it's so hard to ask for something. So if you begin to think of it like you do, the bay, if you begin to think, is that Subway?
No, it says the bay.
Oh, okay. All right. Very good. So if you begin to think, well, you're giving somebody an opportunity to help you, it becomes a whole lot easier to ask for their support. And then you always think, how do I give it back? I knew my boss at Sony. He'd been in business so much longer than me. He was such a smart guy. There was nothing I could do for him, but I had a standing offer. If there's anybody on your team that ever needs a little mentorship, you know, they need a little kick in the rear end, a little help along the way, just call me. I'm there for you, anything I can do. So we had that understanding. And it's still a really cordial call. I haven't talked to him in a year. I could pick up the phone and ask him a question now. Those are the kinds of relationships you want to build on that informal or formal board of directors. I want you to think right now, what makes you stand out? What makes you unique? What makes you special? I know we're all special and we're all unique. Yes, yes, of course we are. But what makes you memorable? What makes you unique? If I had you right now, I'm not going to do it, but if I had you share with someone the biggest accomplishment of your life, the thing you are most proud of, just think about that for a minute. That's something special. And for most of us, that's part of our private mythology. We don't share that. Our family knows, our best friend, our significant other, but we don't share that with the rest of the world. Well, start to think about what makes you stand out. Maybe you're bilingual. Maybe you lived abroad for a year. Maybe you started your own nonprofit. It's amazing. I was speaking to a group at PayPal, young leaders, and I asked this question, and I got this, like, well, would anybody care that I was a very successful 10-year hip-hop producer? I said, well, yeah, not that many, you know, of your team here can say that. Another person, well, I'm a former JPL rocket scientist. Anybody care about, well, yeah, I think so. Gee, I started a nonprofit repurposing prom gowns when I was in high school. Yeah, there were great things. People had amazing things to say, but we so take what we say for granted. I mean, what we can do, what our talents are for granted. We assume if we're good at it, so is everybody else. But I'll tell you one that was the biggest eye-opener for me. I was with a group, and we were doing this exercise, and people were sharing that moment, what I call your jaw dropper, when the other people say, you did what? You want one woman executive? Sort of a look like me business suit put together. She said, oh, yeah, I won the Shark Fest swim. And I said, excuse me? You know, the channel swim from Alcatraz to San Francisco, the Shark Fest, cold water, shark-infested waters, 2 years in a row. I said, whoa, that's pretty good. But the ultimate one was when someone told me, there was a woman who happens to be the founder of USA Network, now she's on a lot of corporate boards, and she said to me, she was coaching, she now coaches people for venture capital, and she was coaching one of her clients for a VC round of funding, a woman who had invented a medical device. And once the coaching is through, you know, she's thrown out there in front of the panel, and 10 people, and she's pitching to them. They all happen to be men. And my friend is sitting in the background thinking, watching the pitch. There's nothing she can do. She's not part of the pitch, thinking, please tell them what you used to do. Please tell them about your background. Please don't forget to tell them your background. And we're all hearing this dying, thinking, what did she do? She was an astronaut. Oops, flipped her mind, forgot to tell them that she was one of a handful of, not only a handful of astronauts, a smaller handful of female astronauts who had invented a medical device. Fortunately, she was able to remind them, oh yeah, by the way, I'm a former astronaut. I mean, but that just shows you how we take so much of what we do for granted, and yet to other people, the fact that you produce music or you run marathons, all of those things are meaningful and they make you memorable. May not be the first thing out of your mouth, but you want to weave that into your backstory so people can make that connection with you. Make sense? Okay, think about that. And then moving on, what do you do to create this brand formula, this statement? Some of you may have heard of the term elevator pitch, right? Have you heard that in some of your classes? It's sort of, to me, it's a little tacky and commercially. It's the idea being if you're in the elevator with the CEO or your biggest potential investor, and you've got five floors up the elevator, you can get that pitch out in, you know, 24 seconds. I like to think of it as a promise or a value statement. It's a little bit more elegant. But basically, it is this. My name, your name, helps, builds, develops your core client, learn, create, build, and then the outcome. Jim Smith, I'm making that up, helps investors create, well, you can make up the rest. I'll show you mine and you'll get a sense of that. This is what I say, and this is baseline. You can have, I just told the last group, you don't have to have one resume, by the way. You can have four or five. You can slant them in different ways. Not only is that okay, it's really smart. You want those buzz phrases. You want the words that connect with people to jump off the page. You're in competition with lots of other job seekers. So for me, it's Libby Gill, coaches established and emerging leaders at organizations like, you heard some of them, Inspire Purpose, that's a culture term, Inspire Purpose, and Drive Performance. I work with people in performance, but we get results. That's sort of my foundational elevator pitch, and I've got a few different levels for, you know, you're sitting next to somebody on an airplane or at a social meeting or at a big event, a conference. You can craft it in a few different ways, but I'm telling you, the people who really do this and write it down versus the people that think they've done it and wing it, the ones who really write this down and are able to articulate it and practice it are the ones who are heard and remembered. I did a talk at Deloitte, and there was one fellow, this is a bit of overkill, but he said he had gone through 87 versions of his value statement, his brand promise. That's a lot, but I got to give it to the guy. He was dedicated, and he got it down to what he thought was authentic, organic, represented him, and people would remember. It's really important. You'll hear about this for the rest of your career because it's important, because you can't expect people to just know what you do magically from an introduction or your resume or your LinkedIn page. You need to be able to tell them artfully and memorably. Got it? I want to talk a little bit about executive presence, and this is for when you're in that corporate setting, when you're job interviewing. I'm not talking about coming to class. You can look like, you can say, you can wear, you can do anything you want, but when I go out and speak to corporations, it never ceases to amaze me that even at a company like a Kellogg's or an Intel, at the executive level, they want to talk about presence, that sort of mysterious idea of how you come across, how you are perceived by others. Got it? This always makes a difference. And when you're starting out, and even beyond that, there are three things. I think of this as the three V's. These are the things that matter the most and that people hire me to talk about for sometimes 2 or 3 days at a time. First are the visual cues. And as I said, you can wear whatever you want here. But visual cues, if you're going for that corporate job, when I say entry level, I don't mean bottom of the, I don't mean bottom of the ladder. I mean you're starting your career with this company. You're interviewing for a job. What you look like is critically important. And I remind this to people at the senior vice president level. I'll give you a story about an executive who was at a company that you will recognize because they have big mouse ears. And she was a senior vice president, loved this woman, highly capable, but a little introverted, didn't want to take over a room. When there was a big staff or board meeting, she would let her people all sit up front, and she would sit around the, you know, the perimeter of the room. She was a senior vice president. She also loved to wear her sweatshirts, her Mouse House sweatshirts, and her kids, and her jeans. It was entertainment. She could, but she shouldn't. People looked at her. She looked young. She sounded young. They thought, you know, she was the intern, not the senior VP. It was wrong. I had to take her, drag her sort of kicking and screaming to do something about that visual appearance because she sent a message. To some people, it said, I don't really care. To some people, it said, I'm really sloppy. To some people, it said, I'm incompetent or I'm checked out. But whatever it was, there were very few people who thought, wow, she's a professional, and yet she's so charmingly casual. It just didn't happen. So you really do have to think about that appearance, the visual cues. That includes your posture. It includes all the stuff your parents told you that you think is silly, but it's not. It really includes all of the way that when you meet someone, and this includes across the table at an interview, when you're going to spend half an hour with them and conceivably meet three more people, they've got a good sense of you in about the first 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds. It's what you look like. It's your carriage. Anybody seen any of the Amy Cuddy TED Talks? It's a great thing to take a look at. Look up Amy Cuddy, C-U-D-D-Y. She does this thing called, Harvard professor, she does this thing called power poses. And it's the, you know, the people who take more room and take more space and spread out, and it comes right from the animal kingdom. We are perceived as stronger and more comfortable. We're okay to take up room because we deserve it. I'm not suggesting you own the table if you're coming into that setting and spread out everywhere, but you also don't want to come creeping in as though you don't deserve to be there. Right? Make sense? Next, you've got to look at vocal energy. And vocal energy is really how you come across, how you sound. And there's a really easy way to find out if friends or family have not already given you some feedback, and that's your phone. Just record yourself and listen to your own speech. One great criticism of the millennials is the uptalk, where you end everything that's even a statement, like a question. Do you know people that do this? And what happens? We discount them immediately. They have no credibility. They just lose it in the question at the end of a statement. It just doesn't sound strong or credible or intelligent. Lower your rate of speech. Lower your pitch. It's a little harder for women than men. But it's not really about your depth of your voice. It's about putting some punch and some energy and some color in it. Right? Do you have any of those professors who just drone on until you want to shoot yourself? And I'm not talking about Dr. Sterling, of course. But you know the difference when you all listen all day long. It can be really hard if someone doesn't change the rate of speech. They have no color. They have no life. They have no energy in their voice. And what they tell people who do telemarketing and sales, put a smile in your voice. You can hear it. I typically stand. When I recorded a couple books on tape and was told I was one of only two authors who had stood for 4 days while I recorded the book. I didn't want to sit. I thought that would flatten the energy. And so I stood so I could deliver that. The last one, and this is sort of my use of this word veritas, which is Latin for truthfulness, is a sense of influence, of power, of significance of message, authenticity. It's having some oomph to what you say. It's having the ring of truth and importance. And it doesn't matter. I was at a group, a manufacturing company recently, and there were about 25 people in this global team, and we were doing a two-day workshop. And there was a young person who I'll never forget. She was 23 years old, had been out of school 2 years. She came with a perspective of a 22-year-old who'd been out of school for 2 years, but she had great credibility and great confirmation about she was giving us the perspective, a consumer perspective, from her point of view. And it mattered. And it mattered because she made us believe it was important, as opposed to someone who's sort of apologizing because maybe they don't know as much as they should. Don't be one of those people. Come across with conviction. A little bit more about this. You've probably seen there are a lot of studies these days on confidence, particularly for women, but I find it applies also to men. And there's one study that I particularly love that came out of UC Santa Barbara, out of the Haas School of Business. UC Berkeley. The study that came out of UC Berkeley, the Haas Business School. And they did a series of studies across students, professors, and administration. So they had a good cross-section of ages and, you know, ethnicities and everything, and gender, and it was a good mix of people. And the study was sort of a general knowledge test, but there were multiple pieces to it. And people were just asked to answer questions where they would, you know, they'd show what they knew about all different kinds of things. And what they found across these series of studies, the people who were the most vocal and the most participatory, even if they were wrong, were the ones who were the most respected, the most admired, and even a few people said, and the most beloved. So interesting to me. I mean, one test was check the box if you know this name, a battle or a novel or some famous event in history. But they made up a bunch of this stuff, and people continued to check those boxes, even though they were purely fictional. And yet, people still thought the people who checked the most boxes, who seemed to have the most information, were the ones who would succeed. Fascinating. You can read that on my blog if you go to libbygill.com and just write confidence in the search bar. Really interesting study. So what the study authors, the researchers that did this study, their takeaway was that if you are a hiring manager, if you're in a position to bring people in, you need to look past that sort of veneer of confidence. You need to look more deeply, which I agree with. But I took it in another direction. To me, it meant if you are in the hiring, in the about-to-be-hired seat, not the hiring manager, but the hiree, you need to take a page from the playbook of the confident people and learn how to ramp it up on occasion. And that, even if you're an introvert, and introverts can ramp it up, it's like a muscle that you use. And here are some of the keys to confidence that I still teach and train senior level executives on, because it can be very difficult in a, even in a friendly environment, definitely in a hostile environment, but in a new place, in a new role, in a new level of management. You want to participate at meetings. Even when you go into a job interview, don't wait to let somebody drag it out of you. This is your moment in the sun. It doesn't mean you talk over everything they say, but be ready to share. You are there to be a participant, not a passive listener. Check the news. Basic, again, if you're in a setting with people that you need to influence or impress, check the headlines. I'm not a big sports fan, except for basketball, but I know what season it is. I don't want to be an idiot. I know when there's a debate, an election. You've got to know the basics. You've got to know what's happening in the world, even if you scan the headlines. I've told this to many executives, and they said, ooh, I got tripped up on that one. I didn't realize some major world event had happened, and this woman is talking on while everybody else is focused on this event. You got to know those things. At a network, what I mean by go for the solo person, if you go to a networking, any of you have to go to any sort of big group functions, networking, college events, where you're meant to meet people, the best way to break the ice is not to stand in a little cluster with people that you already know, because you already know them. Go find somebody who's standing there alone, because they're in the same quandary that you are. They don't know what to do or who to talk to. You will be saving their life if you go up to them and say, hey, my name is Dawn, and your question can always be, how long have you been with this group? Oh, gee, your first time? Mine too. Or gee, you've been in this group for 2 years? Great, what do you think? You've got an automatic icebreaker wherever I go. And for those of you who are introverts in the room, raise your hand. Love to put introverts on the spot. Good for you. I consider myself a situational extrovert. I can do it when I need to because I've been trained and I do it. But even those introverts, you've got to find those moments. And if you have a formula, I'm going to meet two people. No, you don't have to meet six. You don't have to meet five. I'm making that up. You figure it out. But know that you're going there with a mission. I'm having one quality conversation, and then I can go home, right? So you take the fear and emotion out of it because you've already dictated the outcome. Now it's just up to you to make it happen. Dress the part. I mentioned already how critical visual cues are, because they are. I've got, you know, my hipster, he would kill me for calling him a hipster, but he's got the beard and the tattoos and the backward baseball cap and all that kind of stuff. But he knows how to put on a long sleeve shirt and take the ball cap off and look like a grown-up when it's dictated, when he needs to get a job and further his education. So you've got to be aware of that. Basically, you're manipulating your environment, and that is a good thing. I don't mean that for evil. You are getting the result that you want. It's up to you to dictate those terms. And then finally, always focus on contribution. When you're networking, when you're meeting somebody, when you're at that event, hey, how can I help you? Is there anybody that I know that you need to know? I have people ask me this in business all the time. And I find it a very gracious question, and maybe a little highfalutin for students, but they'll say, is there someone in my network I can introduce you to? But, you know, is there someone you need to know on campus? Is there some way I can help you? That's all. People will remember you. Maybe not now, because we tend to be cynical and jaded, some of us. But later, when you deliver on that promise, people are going to remember you as the person that volunteered to help on that all-nighter or to study for a test or to do something that you needed help with. We're the people that get ahead. I'm going to tell you one little last story, and then we're going to open this up to questions. This is, I've already bragged on my kids because they're students. One's creative writing major at Oberlin, and the other is my UCSD grad who's on his way to grad school, international business school, working abroad for a year. And when my son was young, he said he became ill and was in and out of hospital. I'm sure some of you have experienced that or have loved ones who did. And when he got well, finally, it was during the last 2 years of high school, a really bad time to be sick, but finally he's over it, he's okay. And he said to me, Mom, and he'd aced his SATs and gotten into his first choice school. He said, let's go on vacation. And I said, sure, where do you want to go? And he said, Bhutan. And I said, great, where's Bhutan? And he told me, you know, it's in between China and India, I found out. And we, after that tough couple of years, we trekked to the top of this Himalayan mountain to this monastery that was called the Tiger's Nest that was supposedly dropped there by a flying tiger, actual tiger with wings, that put it on the side, because it's on a sheer cliffside, and you can't imagine how it could possibly be built there. But we climbed up there. Well, you know, for those of you who are serious hikers or marathons, that'd probably be a walk in the park for me, for you. For me, it was 8,000. We were already at 8,000 feet, and then we went another 3,000 and 1,400 steps. So it was quite a climb. So my mantra in the corporate world that is a sort of my go-to quote of my own now has a special ring and meaning to it. And it's lift as you climb. Lift as you climb. So when you're on your way to wherever you're going and you stop to take people with you in whatever guise that is, as a fellow student, as a roommate, as a coworker, as a participant, and you take people with you, they will always remember you. And you will have the good fortune that you'll really go far in your career if you remember to do that. The influence and the inspiration that you provide others, I know it sounds corny, but I'm telling you, when you take people with you on the journey, that's returned to you manyfold. So thank you very much for listening. This is where you can find me and my books. And by the way, I have an important gift. This is my latest ebook. It's on my website, and it's a free download. If you all sign up for my newsletter, you'll be able to download that, and I can stay in touch. And I do lots of things to give back. I love working with students. I do a lot with student population, like webinars and Q&A calls and freebies and stuff like that, but a lot about business and building your personal brand on my blog and my website. So I would be delighted to see you there, and I'll throw out one more thing before Dr. Sterling comes back, and that is somewhere in your journey, you want a different perspective, a point of view, shoot me an email, libby@libbygill.com. I'd be happy to answer your question. Remind me where you came from, and people do this. I know only a handful of people will do it, but just say, hey, I was in Ken Sterling's class at UCSB, and you said you'd answer a question, and I will. And thank you very much.
We've got some students here in the front row who have prepared some questions, and I thought we'd start down here. If you'd stand up, state your name, and then your question.
Hi, thanks for presenting for us again, taking the time out. My name is Preston. I'm a junior here at the TMP program. So in your article, Leadership, Be a Charismatic Connector, you really emphasize the importance of charismatic leadership. And I was just wondering what advice you would give to someone who's shy or has a hard time stepping out of their comfort zone to kind of uptake those characteristics.
Thank you, Preston, for that. That's a good question. It can be hard, as I mentioned, for people who are naturally introverted and shy are not the same. Shy is that real sense of social awkwardness, of not wanting to be front and center. Introverted people can sometimes are okay with that, but they prefer to process alone. They'd rather listen than talk. Again, it's a practice. There are times, and as you all know, the world is set up for extroverts. And just like the study on confidence that I mentioned, people that didn't even know the right answer were still considered more confident because they spoke up. So there are times you've got to work that like a muscle. You have to practice in an environment that feels safe. It can be one-on-one, trading interview questions with someone, joining a small group, going to a Toastmasters. And by the way, if you ever do that, anybody that really wants to work on their speaking, Toastmasters are little sort of networking groups, and they're just, you go to Toastmasters.org and it will find the closest one. Shop like a consumer. If you go there and say, this doesn't fit my vibe, I don't like these people, try one in the next community over because they're everywhere. It's practicing it until you can go a little bigger, a little broader, a little more comfortable, and eventually you get there and you sort of forget, yes, I'd prefer to be back there solo writing or doing my thing, but there are times I've got to just ramp it up. I have an executive that I worked with who we labeled his meetings because he was shy, but he was being perceived as passive, and he was a new VP. His meetings became one, two, or three level. A one was ramp it up. You're on display. You got to know your stuff. You got to be prepared, and you got to wear a suit. Two was a meeting, not the big wigs, but that next level down, a little more relaxed, a little less formal, but still on. A three was just shooting the breeze with his own staff, blue jeans, tennis shoes, Friday morning, you know, that kind of thing. And just having that qualification really helped him relax about the less important meetings and focus on the big ones.
Thank you so much, Libby.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.